Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, Editor-in-Chief of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today I'm joined by one of our contributing editors, James Mottram.
Hello.
Hello. So this week we are talking action comedy, Polite Society, old age pensioner weepy, The Unlikely Pilgrimage of Harold Fry, boxing biopic, Big George Foreman, the miraculous story of the once and future heavyweight champion of the world, that is really its title, and the documentary Little Richard, I Am Everything. But before we get onto those, what have you been watching this week, James?
Like everyone else, finished off The Mandalorian. I was a bit late to it because I had to wait until my partner was, she'd been away all week, so I had to wait till the weekend, and then kept reading people online going, oh, it's not a very good ending, or it's not a very good season finale, but I really enjoyed it. In fact, we both really enjoyed it. I thought it was a splendid end to season three.
How do you not know to stay offline if you haven't seen something, James? Honestly, don't be looking.
Well, yeah, but it's just if you just turn on Twitter, you're not looking for Mandalorian stuff, but just people are just babbling about it. And, you know, some people are saying, oh, they really liked it. And then they were saying, oh, but I hear, you know, lots of other people don't like it. I try not to, you know, you try and phase these things out. So I watched that, and I'm continuing my love affair with Ted Lasso, which I've only got into fairly recently. I'm, you know, fairly up to date on that. Yeah, that's very enjoyable. Have you watched that at all?
I've not seen a single Ted Lasso. So, and I'm at that stage, you know, like as everyone does, where it's gone on so long, I feel like people have banged on about it for so long that I don't want to start it out of a sort of peevishness almost.
I understand that peevishness, not specifically with Ted Lasso, but just generally. With anything, I get that. That's that kind of like, oh, everyone says it's amazing, it can't be that good. And I know you're not a massive football fan, but you don't really have to like football. That's very much the backdrop. It's very, very character driven. I think you'll like it. Give it a go. It started when everyone was initially in lockdown.
Yeah.
And I can see why people took to it then, because it was the sort of perfect antidote to kind of the lockdown blues. So, yeah, I'd say give it a go.
Nope, still being peevish in this corner. I now have to wait for it to tip right over until it's gone completely out of fashion and everyone's like done a reverse ferret and hates it. Then I might start watching it. There's something about it. There's a mental block when everybody wangs on about something. I just can't. I've still got The Wire on a box set unopened.
Oh, now you do. Well, I'm not about to say, well, you really should watch that, but
I know, but you now really should. I know, but now I feel like we are in the place that I can actually go and look at that. It's like I only watched Breaking Bad like 2 years ago, so I'm behind. I know I am. I know, but anyway, I was saw a very sneaky peek of a superhero movie last night, and I have been watching with great interest, obviously not seeing any of the footage, but all of the stuff coming out of CinemaCon this week.
I was reading, I saw a lovely picture of Ryan Gosling in a nice pink blush jacket,
into that Barbie.
Yeah, with Greta Gerwig's name written on his chest, I believe. Can't wait to see a bit of Barbie. What else have you seen out of CinemaCon so far?
I mean, there was all the Dune stuff yesterday as well. It was the Warner Brothers panel yesterday, which is where we saw Barbie, but all the Dune stuff came out, which sounds exciting. Timothy Chalamet saying that he rode on a like physical sandworm. They created a physical sandworm for Paul to ride on. That I want to see. The news that Austin Butler's antagonist is pale, bald, and like, what do they call it? An Olympic swordsman crossed with a psychotic Mick Jagger.
Nice.
That sounds good.
I didn't actually see any of the Dune stuff. I saw lots of mention of Wonka, the other Shyamalan thing that's coming, where he's swimming in a pool of chocolate, which is, you know, my idea of heaven, obviously. So looking forward to seeing that. It's quite annoying when they say, all these trailers have been released, but they haven't actually been released. They're just there for the audiences at CinemaCon so far, anyway.
The lucky swines that are there, yes. And obviously I'm now recalling my chat with Butler back in October when I was trying desperately to get any indication of what he might look like out of him. And he was just like giggling and being very evasive. And clearly because he's bald as a coot in it, and we finally got our answer. Should we have a listen?
The hair is still there, so that's good. Is it? I don't know.
CinemaCon really is the big cheese now, isn't it? It's become this big thing. It's almost like taken over from Comic-Con in the terms of revealing big things and new projects and exciting looks. I kind of
it's not restricted just to sort of the fantasy comic book world that Comic-Con is. So it is anything, isn't it? So yeah, as you say, you've got June, you've got Wonka, you've got Barbie, all these, the great melting pot that's coming towards us over the next few months.
And that's just the Warner Brothers releases. They've done all other panels as well. I think I might attempt to go next year. Last year was all Don't Worry, Darling and the serving of the divorce papers and all that shenanigans. It just seems like it's the place stuff happens. We may need to book our tickets, James.
Indeed.
Okay, shall we move on then and have a look at what we can be watching and actually can watch and not just hear about on Twitter? It's time to get your roundhouse kicks ready. It's this.
I'm Rhea Khan. Yeah, yeah. I am going to be a stunt woman. Yeah, yeah. My sister Lena is the only person who believes in me.
Want to help me with a vid for my channel?
She helps me with all my training.
You are going to be such a great stunt woman.
That was dope, though.
But lately, she's been seeing this guy who I think is a bit of a smarmy wanker. You know, it's a trap.
Oh my God, Rhea, chill out.
Now, I'm not being dramatic, but these people are evil.
Okay, so this is Polite Society. James, it sounds like it's a sort of Jane Austen sort of regal drama, but that's not what this is it?
No, I think I went into it thinking it was going to be something along those lines, or at least a contemporary reworking of Jane Austen. And I think there is a little Jane Austen in there.
Yeah.
It's based around a sort of British Pakistani family, two young sisters, an 11-year-old named Rhea, played by Priya Kansara, who is desperate. She loves martial arts and she's desperate to be a stunt woman. That's what she wants to do in her life. And she sort of deeply admires her older sister as well, Lena, played by Rita Aya, who had a desire to be an artist, but she's sort of gradually losing that desire. And of course, her family, they want to kind of pair her off, the older sister, with a suitable bachelor, let's mm-hmm. say. She actually finds one. She finds a nice doctor called Salim, played by Akshay Khanna. And, you know, she's suddenly incredibly happy. But her younger sister, Rhea, does not like Salim at all, this potential brother-in-law. She thinks he's sort of, there's something suspicious about him, she believes.
Yes.
And then she kind of goes, basically trying to disrupt that marriage as much as possible, all the while pursuing her martial arts and love of stunts. It's a very strange mix of, as I say, Jane Austen and Bruce Lee Enter the Dragon style martial arts activity.
Yes. It's, you know, one of these films that I didn't love Everything Everywhere All at Once. It wasn't my favourite, but I feel like this is in a similar realm with that sort of female relationships within a family, kick-ass action, real sense of humour, real verve to it. And I liked this a lot better. How about you?
I found it, so, like I sort of hinted a minute ago, I found it such a strange experience because it completely wrong-footed me as to what I thought it was going to be.
Yeah.
Full marks for originality because, although you just mentioned Everything Everywhere, it's very different to that. It's not obviously dealing with multiverses and things like that.
No.
But I suppose you could say it's more grounded on some level, but it's kind of not. It is a sort of strange fantasy. Yeah, it completely wrong-footed me. I didn't really know what to make of it. I did kind of enjoy it. It's short. It's in and out. It doesn't hang around too long. I thought some of the jokes or some of it went on a little bit too long. It didn't quite work for me in all ways. But it's very unusual, very different. I suppose it reminded me most of Bend It Like Beckham,
yeah,
in a strange way. It's sort of young teenage girl's story, again, where they're pursuing something that perhaps the family don't really approve of. Yeah, but yeah, I wasn't quite sure what to make of it. But I think overall, I certainly actually enjoyed it more than Everything Everywhere, which I'm with you on that. I found that quite tiresome, to be honest. But there you go. It turned out to win the Oscar. So what do I know?
Exactly. What do you know? I mean, what do I know, Isa? Yeah, this I think it's really, you know, and this makes it sound kind of dry and sort of worthy, but it's really great to see a film that is about female relationships, both in the family between the two sisters and the mother, also at school and the sort of bullying that goes on and the way that girls are with each other, but also the sisterhood in her friends, and also the fact that actually the plot does revolve, with no spoilers, around power dynamics between women in society. So it's incredible that it's packaged up in this really entertaining, fast, giddy sort of 90-minute explosion of fun. But actually, it's incredibly important for young women to see this film, I think, and to see themselves reflected and see strong women reflected on the screen. I just think it's a really excellent thing. I'm so pleased to see it, that it exists in the world.
I think we should probably add that it's written and directed by Nida Manzoor, who did the sitcom We Are Lady Parts, which was kind of about an all-female, all-Muslim punk band.
Yep.
So you could say she's got form in this arena already, just sort of portraying a British-Pakistani family like you've never seen them before. I mean, it's a sort of ordinary family, but, you know, when have you ever seen a young girl from such a family who loves martial arts, who wants to be a stunt woman? That, for me, was my favourite element of it, actually. Yeah. I felt that was completely kind of groundbreaking in some ways.
And the sort of fact, you know, it has this classic arc of her trying to do a certain thing and repeatedly failing, and will she be able to do that thing when the time comes and when she really needs to, which is just like a punching the air moment that's a classic sort of Hollywood trope. And then this beautiful scene where she does this dance at a wedding that is pure sort of Bollywood. The editing's very Bollywood, the way it's put together. Yeah, it's a really fresh, exciting and fun film. And I think you don't have to be a teenage girl. You don't have to be Asian. You don't have to be, you know, understand any parts of this to really have a good time. So, you know, I'm surprised you didn't enjoy it more, James.
Yeah, I mean, as I say, it just sort of slightly wrong-footed me, but I did quite enjoy it. But it just, there are points where I just didn't quite know what to make of it. But I think that, as you just mentioned, particularly the teenage demographic will love this, I'm certain. I mean, I feel like it's not just for them, as you said, but they are the core audience, and I think they will enjoy it. I mean, it's funny, I saw someone online saying, why is no one talking more about Polite Society? This was kind of in the run-up to its release. And in a way, I sort of agree. It's like, you know, whatever I thought of it, it feels like a film that, you know, it's coming out now. There's not a huge amount else around at the moment. It's that sort of post-Oscar lull. And this does feel that something that's quite fresh and different and original, like I said. So I feel like if word gets out, people, you know, particularly young teenagers, should go and see this. They will enjoy it.
Yeah, and I fully expect that it might be something that does travel all the way to award season, as in various disciplines, be perhaps nominated, because I do think it's incredibly assured and well put together. So, yeah, I would say go see this. It's fun. It's just a blast. It's a blast to go and watch it. You're a little bit more lukewarm.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't say. But I mean, we'll see at the end when we look at the other films, which is the one that we choose.
Oh, well, that's a very poor sort of recommendation, I think. You're not going gung-ho on it right now.
I'm not going gung-ho. I think, you know, well, what would you give it out of 5? Are you allowed to say that?
I think I'd probably, you know what, give it a high 4, or possibly even a 5.
Oh, my life.
For just absolute sheer verve.
Sheer verve. Okay. I'd probably give it 3.
Okay. Right, well, make up your own mind. It's Polite Society, and it is in cinemas on Friday. Shall we move on then from teenage kicks to pedestrian pensioners? It's this.
Could I leave a message for Queenie Hennessy?
Tell her Harold Fry is on his way. I'll keep walking and she must keep living.
Harold?
I'm walking a long way, but I haven't quite got the hang of it yet.
Yes, Dave.
Are you?
I'm going to save Queenie Hennessy.
Have you been drinking?
The only time you walk is to get to the car.
I need to do this, Maureen.
Walk to Berwick-upon-Tweed. It can only be about 500 miles.
So this is The Unlikely Pilgrimage of Harold Fry, an adaptation of a book James, what is the pilgrimage of Harold Fry? What's he up to?
Well, Harold Fry, played by Jim Broadbent, is a retiree, lives in South Devon with his wife Maureen, played by Penelope Wilton. And he gets a letter one day from an old colleague named Queenie, who basically reveals in this letter that she's in a hospice. She's sort of dying of cancer. And he tries to write a letter to her to, I suppose, express his feelings, express his condolences. He can't really get it right in a letter. And even though he takes something to the post office after meeting a sort of girl in a shop who suddenly inspires him, he decides to set out on foot to go and visit Queenie. Now, that's 500 miles away in Berwick-upon-Tweed. And you might be asking at this point, why doesn't he take the train, apart from the fact that trains are vastly overpriced and terrible? But it's because he feels if he walks there, it will help her, knowing that he's coming, it'll help her stay alive. It's a sort of hence the pilgrimage aspect of the title. So that's exactly what he does. He sets off on foot, enjoys the kindness of strangers along the way as he heads to see Queenie.
Yeah, I mean, any surprises for you in this? I mean, it really is one of those films that feels like it was created by AI. Like, we need a film that's a heart warmer. We want a sort of Calendar Girls, Fisherman's Friends-esque sort of heartwarming, uplifting tale. Want to get the silver pound in. So AI has produced Jim Broadbent, this walk, and a dog. Let's get a dog in there. Let's get quirky folk in there. You know, like, let's tap into a little bit of that Forrest Gump aspect when he was running coast to coast. We'll put in a little bit of religiousness, not too much, but the suggestion of maybe a higher force.
There's quite a lot. I think towards the end, it gets very spiritual. And actually, yeah. I didn't find that too cloying. I thought by the end it's one of these films where its heart is completely in the right place.
Yes, absolutely.
And you're right. There is some cynical elements that you could say it feels a little packaged in that way. That was probably the most irritating element of the film. Mostly, I mean, Broadbent's obviously a fantastic actor and carries this off very well. I thought Penelope Wilton as the wife left behind, they both have sort of issues themselves that haven't been dealt with, sort of emotional baggage that they're carrying. And she had a difficult and kind of thankless role, but I thought she carried it off pretty well, considering. It's certainly a vast improvement on the last, I think it's called The Last Bus with Timothy Spall.
Yes, that's exactly what it reminded me of, yeah.
Yeah, where he similarly goes on a sort of, trip around England, and that was far cornier and, you know, didn't really have the kind of emotional impact that this at least attempts to get towards. And I think to some degree, you know, it is, towards the end, it is quite moving in places. It's probably not on the level of something like Calendar Girls, as you just mentioned, but it serves an audience, I think, that don't always get served.
Yes, it's very cozy, isn't it? It's as and sweet. And, you know, if you enjoy looking at towns in England as he passes through them, past Exeter Cathedral and Blue Sheffield and past the Angel of the North, as a sort of travel log, it's rather nice. But yeah, I agree with you. I think whilst ever it's Jim Broadbent and his particular odyssey that feels almost like Into the Wild or something, when he eschews modern comfort in order to just really be and be fully present and in the moment, that's a kind of lovely film. And I think I would have liked more of that introspective idea of him trying to heal himself from a great wound that he's suffering from. And at the same time, his wife discovering that this unexpected odyssey that he goes on is something that actually might benefit them both. I loved that aspect. I think what I didn't like was, as you say, the sort of the cute dog, the young quirky chap that joins him, the people with their posters and trying to make it more cutesy and sweet, when actually at the heart of this, it's a story about death and grief and how you move forward through that. And that's really interesting to me. But yeah, I mean, it's not a bad film. And I think Broadbent's delightful. I mean, have you ever seen him be bad in anything? I haven't. He's incredible. And yeah, so I don't think it's a bad film. I'm just not sure that anybody would be rushing out to see this.
No, as you say, it's very cozy, comfy. It's the sort of thing that you'd happily watch on a Sunday night on TV when it comes around. Yeah. I think, you know, that definitely. Oddly, the the element that you were talking about with kind of grief. I think the fact that he has to leave his wife behind is quite difficult. And then she pops up in a couple of points, which were quite contrived in the way that she suddenly manages to track him down in the middle of Sheffield or something. And that didn't quite work for me. Whereas perhaps if, I mean, this is adjusting the story slightly, but if she'd gone on the pilgrimage with him, maybe they could have worked through those issues you were talking about. I'm not sure, but I'm not sure if that would have worked either.
No, but there is a point where she says to him, you know, he said, join me. And she says, no, I haven't got my things. And he's like, you don't need things. And she's like, I do need my things. And I'm that person. So I totally understand that she is that person that isn't into camping, doesn't want to wash in a stream, not interested in building fires and that. I don't love to camp. So I do think she's a very recognisable person in that dynamic. She is for me anyway.
I do think they missed out a trick on not playing the Proclaimers, you know, I will walk 500 miles on the soundtrack. I mean, I really wanted to hear that when he was marching along the highways and byways of Britain. I do think it's also quite interesting to try and, and most people have failed, really, to try and make a road movie in Britain because we don't have the landscapes of America, obviously. There have been a few films in the past. Peter Capaldi's Soft Top, Hard Shoulder was one, and Michael Winterbottom's Butterfly Kiss was kind of a road movie. But yeah, it never quite seems to work, or it gets a bit too, again, it gets a bit too cozy, a bit too sort of cliche. I'd like to see someone make a great road movie one day. There's got to be one there somewhere.
I mean, I love Sightseers. If you want a road movie of Britain that goes to the Pencil Museum, who doesn't love that? That's really great. But yeah, I know what you're saying. And the other thing about this film, and this is just from a personal point of view, is it's not a true story. It's based on a narrative book. But there is a really interesting true story that I'm aware of as a kid. I'm from Bradford, and there used to be a man called that was known locally as the Jesus Man of Bradford. He was a guy who walked around in a monk's robe and sandals and had a backpack and just walked. And people in the area would give him food and shelter or whatever he needed. And he would wave. And ever you saw him, if you were on the bus on the way to school and you saw him, you'd wave at the Jesus Man. And that was a real person and a really quite interesting thing. And I always wondered about his background. And apparently he'd like gone and lived in a cave and settled to get a word from God and then walked to Bradford and had this sort of quite interesting backstory about what had triggered that. So yeah, I sort of thought as I watched it that this is a sweet story, but I bet there's a lot of really interesting real people that this could have been about.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, as you were saying that, I was thinking you should write a script of the Jesus Man of Bradford because that actually sounds pretty good. So
yeah, and if you're listening and you're from Bradford, you probably remember the Jesus Man of Bradford. You probably grew up and saw him walking the streets, this very cheery, smiley man that basically embodied human spirit and goodness, and people just were very happy to see him and waved at him. So yeah, there you go. I'm selling that to you, Studio Canal or Pathé. The Jesus Man of Bradford, who wants it? Directed by Scorsese. That's what I'm going for. But anyway.
Kind of like Silence, the sequel to Silence,
there you
basically.
Go. He loves a monk. So there we go. Are we recommending then The Unlikely Pilgrimage of Harold Fry?
Yes. That doesn't sound very convincing either, does it?
No, doesn't. I think it's one that if you love Jim Broadbent and you want something very unchallenging, off you go. But I think it's probably best waited for small screen at home.
I would agree.
Okay, so that is The Unlikely Pilgrimage of Harold Fry, and it's out in cinemas on Friday. Right, then, time to get in the ring with this one.
George Foreman ain't no new champ. He is the new chump. We gonna get it on because we don't get along.
Foreman goes down!
Who said that?
Nobody said nothing, George.
George.
Your heart stopped. We thought you was dead.
I was. I'm done. I'm not going to box anymore.
Do you know what you're walking away from, son?
And I want to spread the word of God and what I saw.
How's being a preacher going for you?
It's hard.
Harder than getting punched in the face.
Sometimes it feels about the same.
Hey, fella, come on and enjoy yourself.
Power company said we never paid the bill.
Really?
It's only two things I know how to do. That's box and preach. And preaching won't pay the bills.
So this is, and here we go, this is the full title, Big George Foreman, colon, The miraculous story of a once and future heavyweight champion of the world. James, would you like to expand on that?
No, there's no more time because that title was so long. I actually didn't even know that was the full title. I thought it was just called Big George Foreman. But there we go. So obviously this is based around the real heavyweight boxing champion, George Foreman. It covers a great deal of his life, you know, his sort of poor upbringing, when he starts boxing, his rising through the ranks. Of course, it covers the Rumble in the Jungle when he fights Muhammad Ali, played by Sullivan Jones, and Foreman's played by a guy called Chris Davis, who is, you know, really does embody him very, very well. And then it covers his sort of time as a preacher, which is quite a little unusual diversion away from boxing. And then the return to the ring where in his 40s, he decides to fight again. So it covers a lot of ground. I thought a little bit too much ground on some level, particularly as there's about 10 years or so between those periods when he's boxing. And that it just feels like quite a lot of ground to cover. It's directed by George Tillman Jr., who made Men of Honor, quite a sort of veteran director. You know, honestly, the best thing about it by a long way is Forrest Whitaker, who plays his boxing coach. I mean, he just steals every scene that he's in without even trying. He's just... Sometimes when you see a film and you think, there's an actor who's just operating on a higher level than anyone else in the film. Not that anyone else is particularly bad. It's just that, you know, Whitaker's just way, way above everybody else. I feel like after we've seen something like Creed 3, now I realize that's fantasy on some level. I mean, it's, you know, I felt the boxing scenes were a little pedestrian here. It has moments, but it on some level, I would have preferred a tighter focus on the, you know, the 70s era form and the Rumble in the Jungle era, rather than just sort of going plodding through various points in his life. Of course, the George Foreman grill does get a brief mention. I was hoping for more.
George Foreman grill.
Well, everyone loves their. I sat through most of the film thinking, when are they going to mention the George Foreman grill? And then someone in the bank. He has sort of financial problems at one point. And then someone mentions, well, that grill deal that you signed is doing rather well. And that's the only mention you get of it until the end credits, where they say what an incredible amount of money he made from that. And maybe it was just, just this random thing he decided to endorse, which suddenly exploded. But I would have thought that would have been a kind of more popular or at least a bigger part of his life to mention. But that's it. There's so much ground to cover. And the film's just over 2 hours. It perhaps tried to do too much in some ways.
Now, who is this for then? Is this for a casual boxing person, someone who has a passing relationship to boxing, or is this for boxing fans? Who would you say the audience for this is?
Yeah, good question. I guess boxing fans, first of all, because obviously Foreman is a huge figure within the boxing universe. But again, they probably would have wanted more focus on his fights. I guess a bit like we were talking about with Harold Fry and its kind of Christian message. There's quite that, you know, there's a strong element of that as well.
Yeah, faith.
And, you know, that's a huge part of his life. So it certainly couldn't be ignored. But that's why it might be, it's a traditional biopic. That's what I came out of this thinking. It's not Raging Bull. It's nothing kind of radical in that way in terms of the way it presents boxing or the way it's a sort of soul-searching character study. It's a fairly traditional, I hate to use the word pedestrian, but it was slightly pedestrian portrayal of his life. I think Foreman's sort of been heavily involved with this as well, which is fine. Yeah, perhaps that's why it's a little, as I say, pedestrian.
I mean, in terms of authority and having, you know, the approval of the family, then that's good for fans. But then sometimes maybe that stops something from being as creative as it could be. It feels perhaps a little sanitized, would you say?
Yeah, I mean, it does go into at one point his, you know, sort of marital issues and sort of infidelities and things like that. So it's not completely sanitized. But yeah, perhaps it could have been more hard hitting. You know, compared to, say, I don't know, Michael Mandali or something like that. I mean, you know, it's not operating at that level, basically. It's perfectly serviceable as a Foreman life story. And as I mentioned earlier, Chris Davis really does embody Foreman very well. You know, he does his best in the boxing scenes. I just don't think they're particularly thrilling to watch. You know, even in the sort of Rumble in the Jungle sequence, which you sort of would expect that to be, you know, the apex of the film, really.
Yeah, I guess that's a tricky thing. When you have to show somebody who's an exceptional talent at something, you really want to sell that aspect of their life. And if it's falling down in this aspect, then maybe it's not quite working. So, you know, Elvis, you want to be able to see what it was that made him so popular. And the same is true of this.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned Elvis. And if you think about those concert scenes and how, as you say, kinetic they were, that's exactly what made him famous, was sort of going on stage and thrilling audiences like that. And you would have to say the same for Foreman. That's, you know, when he performed in the ring, that's was what people came and paid their money and watched him for. The boxing scenes aren't, you know, terrible. They're just, I suppose, I think coming so close to Creed 3, where I did actually think Michael B. Jordan did a fantastic job. I thought he did a great job generally, but I thought he did a great job in those boxing scenes, which were really, really were kinetic. And maybe that is partly because with a kind of Rocky type story, you can get away with a little bit more hyper-realism, let's say, where it's a little bit heightened. And you know, perhaps they weren't going for that here. They wanted to sort of portray it like it was. I guess when you're building up to those scenes, you want a bit of punch, really, to use a pun.
Yes, I like what you've done there. Okay, so if you want to see Big George Foreman, it is out in cinemas on Friday. Okay, shall we move on to another incredible act? It is the final film for this week, Let It All Hang Out, with this.
It's just like a shot out of a cannon.
His voice? My God, who is that?
He created the rock and roll icon.
Sorry, y'all. It wasn't Elvis.
I am the king of rock and roll!
The first songs that you love that your parents hate is the beginning of the soundtrack of your life.
Little Richard's lyrics were too lewd to get airplay on the radio.
They was not that dirty. They were just as clean as you were.
So this is Little Richard, I'm Everything, which I saw at Sundance earlier this year, and you saw more recently, James. Tell us what aspect of Little Richard's life it explores.
Well, it goes through his sort of early career, or it goes through kind of most of his career, really. And as much as it's dealing with his music, it's dealing with his sexuality as well, and how he grappled with that over time. Again, oddly, we're in a very spiritual mode this week after Harold Fry and George Foreman, because, of course, he had, you know, religious conversion as well, which again made his issues with his homosexuality or his bisexuality very, very difficult to cope with. And I mean, it's got your obvious talking heads from the music world. Mick Jagger's there. John Waters pops up, which is always
and
a pleasure.
And John Waters and his little pencil moustache, inspired by Little Richard.
Yes, yes. But then you've got sort of, you know, cultural commentators as well, who are able to put his sexuality in sort of context of, well, you know, living in the from the 1950s onwards. You know, I'll be honest, Little Richard is one of those artists that my father listens to, so I know those songs, but I knew very little about his backstory. I'm not even sure if I knew, you know, that he was gay. I didn't know any of that. I didn't even know what Tutti Frutti, the song,
well,
was about.
Saucy.
Which, yeah, very saucy. I'm not even sure if we could go into that here. Perhaps we should leave that for listeners to discover if they watch the film. But I was shocked. I don't know if you were.
I wasn't shocked. I was tickled. I was like, oh, I will listen to that entirely differently. I found this an invigorating watch. You know, the boldness of this person who appears like a comet in the middle of the sort of 1950s, and just, he is, you know, the ultimate rock and roll performer. He's wearing makeup. He's got this huge high hair. He's wearing these very fancy clothes. He is sleeping with women. He's sleeping with men. He is wearing female clothing that at the time wasn't seen. He was performing in the South as a black man, as a sort of very feminized black man, but also extremely raunchy black man, and getting away with things that ordinarily would have been incredibly dangerous to do. And just had this incredible self-belief that he was incredibly talented. He's so entertaining in the clips we see of him in this film that he's like, yeah, I was hot. I was sexy. I was incredibly brilliant at this. It's weird that he can say those things and you don't think that he's boastful. You think, I love that he's self-confident about his talents. So I just found this a very enlightening and uplifting documentary. And yeah. And it really filled me in on, you know, like, sorry to mention Elvis again, kind of like it, but that film, it touches upon Little Richard slightly in one scene where Elvis goes to Club Handy and sees him perform and is like, that guy's amazing. But in reality, he was an absolute trailblazer for Elvis. There wouldn't have been an Elvis Presley without Little Richard.
But there's a lot in the film, although you talk about his self-confidence on stage, which yes. is definitely true. I mean, this is the man who stands on pianos and so yeah. forth. You know, towards the end of the film, they talk about, you know, as he got later in his life, I don't think he felt truly appreciated for you know, for what he has done for music. And I mean, he didn't die that long ago. It was 2020, wasn't it, when he was, I think, 87. And yeah, towards the end of his life, I don't think he's quite had the recognition that perhaps he deserves. I mean, there's a brilliant montage at the end of the film where it runs through the likes of, you know, it's just clips of like David Bowie yeah. and Freddie Mercury, right up to Harry Styles flaunting around on stage in his wonderful costumes. And all of these guys and many more that they run through in this montage have clearly all descended from Little Richard on some yeah. level. And yet, you think, well, why hasn't he quite got that recognition? And maybe this film will help a little bit in sort of rectifying that. But it does a really good job of pointing out how vital he was in the early days of rock and roll.
We throw the term trailblazer around to describe a lot of people, but truly, him arriving when he did at this point in pop culture and social intersection was something that no one had ever seen before. And yeah, it's an amazing film to give you that appreciation. Neither of us knew and were aware of his music, so it does feel like it's actually something that will educate as well as entertain.
Mm. And there's sort of lovely clips of, well, almost pre-fame Beatles, really. McCartney's not interviewed afresh for this, but there is footage of McCartney talking about Little Richard and I think John Lennon as well. They were all like little puppy dogs, basically kind of staring up at him when they met him because they were so, you know, in love with this guy and you know, obviously influenced by his music. And I think he took them around clubs in Hamburg and so yeah. forth and all of that stuff. So he's been there, seen it, done it all with all of those major yeah. musicians. Bowie, I think, handed, I think it was his producer, when he made the Let's Dance album, he was kind of like, right, well, I want it to be something like this, and then showed him a picture of, you know, Little Richard or whatever. Yeah. Again, that's such an iconic album, Let's Dance, and yet it's clearly its roots stretch all the way back to Little Richard. So quite why, I mean, obviously it's, you know, we're stretching back 70 odd years now into sort of musical history, but he's someone that needs to be remembered.
And celebrated.
Mm.
Okay, so if you fancy learning a little bit more about Little Richard, I am everything. He is everything. He's just fabulous. It is in cinemas on Friday. That's all we have time to talk about this week. What's your film of the week, James?
Well, even though I might not have sounded like it at the beginning, I'm going to go for Polite Society. I think because of its originality and sort of gusto, I think people should go and see it, and I think we'll enjoy it when they do.
Same. I think Polite Society is a breath of fresh air and a real sort of shot in the arm. And you're just going to come out with a smile on your face. But also, I really did enjoy Little Richard. I think it's really enlightening. So, yeah, I'd twofer on those. A reminder then, if you like this podcast, you can make your life easier by subscribing. Press the button and we will come to your platform just like that, like fairies in the night. You'll just appear. We should also say, what is coming out on shelves that can be bought today, James?
Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny issue.
Yes! The new issue is on sale and it has Harrison Ford on the cover, and we get into it on Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny. I'm so excited. Like, it's coming to Cannes. That's when we'll see the film. You'll be in Cannes, James.
Yes, yes. I am excited because obviously I saw number four, Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. That was also in Cannes. I remember sitting right at the top of the Lumiere Theatre in literally practically the back row for some strange reason, probably because it was super crowded. I actually didn't mind Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. I know that is not a popular statement, but compared to the previous three, it's it is a little lower down on the indie spectrum. But yeah, I have high hopes for this one. I'm sure you do as well. Yeah. I think just the idea of seeing Ford, they're obviously going to play him as a sort of, you know, an 80-year-old, as an old man, basically.
He's a 70-year-old, actually, in the film.
Oh, is it 70-year-old?
His character is 70. He's 80 himself, but he is 70 in the film.
But, you know, playing him in that age bracket, let's say, I think that will, hopefully that will work. They're not going to give him too many superhuman things to do, let's say. But even in his prime, he was never doing anything too crazy. I mean, he's not a superhero in that sense.
I mean, this is sort of set against the moon landings and that sort of aspect of Americana. So I love the fact that Indy is generally in relief to something that's sort of happening historically. But obviously Nazis are still involved because we love Indy kicking Nazi ass. So I'm here for it. And Mads Mikkelsen is playing his sort of adversary with his various henchmen.
Yeah, don't forget Boyd Holbrook as
Can I forget Boyd Holbrook? I love Boyd Holbrook. He's amazing. And then obviously Phoebe Waller-Bridge as his goddaughter, all along for the ride.
I think John Rhys-Davies as well, I think, coming back. As
returning, yes, yeah. Salah.
Salah, yeah.
You know, I mean, sadly, Bad Dates Monkey will never return, which is a sad thing that I still...
that is sad. Yeah.
Still haven't got over Bad Dates Monkey. Like, why did that have to happen? Oh. In his tiny little red vest. Anyway, you can read all about Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny in the new issue. We also have coverage of Star Wars Celebration, Guardians of the Galaxy we dip into, Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse, The Little Mermaid, Ari Aster.
A massive interview with Sigourney Weaver.
Who did that one?
I don't know. I've forgotten somebody.
There's some useless scribe that might be talking right now, interviewed the legendary Sigourney Weaver. Jamie Graham interviewed Dario Argento, which...
Oh, my God, he must have exploded when that happened.
Well, I mean, probably exploded with a giant, lurid sort of pop of blood, if it's anything by Argento's standards. And the Boogeyman, get into the new scary movie that is going to haunt your dreams. So, tons to go at. Go and buy it. Please do. It's a cracker. Right, before we go then, final thing. Reader's question, always a reader's question. And this one is probably related to Harold Fry. Where would you go on a pilgrimage to, James?
Is that a real place or a fantasy place, let's
I
say?
Think it could be anything.
Well, I'll give you two. I'll go to Machu Picchu for real. Uh-huh. Or for movie fantasy place, I'll go to Tatooine. In the Star Wars universe. I mean, I know it's a desert, but, you know, I'd like to go to the cantina. That'd be quite fun.
And are you walking there? Or are you going?
Well, it'd be quite a long walk, considering it's a galaxy far, far away. But yeah, maybe a speeder bike. And then I'll walk at the end to the cantina, the last few yards.
Yeah. In terms of sort of Odyssey pilgrimages, film ones, this is something I actually do. I like to go and go to the places that things are filmed. So I have done a Roman Holiday pilgrimage and done all of the scenes from Roman Holiday. A Call Me By Your Name pilgrimage, done all of those. Just did The Warriors in Coney Island and all the way up to the top of New York.
Presumably the tubes, the metro system was less filled with weird people trying to kill you.
Nobody tried to get me on roller skates, which was a disappointment. So, yeah, I went to Hotel Del Coronado so I could reenact Some Like It Hot. I am that person. So I'm trying to think what one I need to do that I haven't done yet.
Well, the one that I really would like to do, which is definitely doable, is to go to the cottage in With Nell and I, because they screen the film there, once or twice a year. Obviously summertime. So you can go there, be surrounded by lots of other Widnell fans and, you know, yell out quotes against the screen, which would probably be quite annoying for anyone who's trying to watch the film, but most people would have seen it a million times. So I think that would be quite, you know, you'd obviously have to get a beaten up old Jag and then, you know, head down the motorway.
You need to be wearing your plastic bags over your shoes and you need to shout at farmers, all escape a bull, Shall we do that? Should we plan that weekend, James? Sounds good.
That sounds excellent.
Yeah. I also remembered the other one I've done, the Dirty Dancing one. I went to the Dirty Dancing Hotel and I did carry a watermelon in the correct place. I did sit in the corner and I did balance on a trunk of a tree and do some dancing. And
No one puts Jane Crowther in the corner.
Nobody does. I did the merengue. I did the lift in a lake. So a very sturdy young man lifted me, I must say. No, that was amazing. And next month, I am going to Memphis to just do all of the real places from Elvis's life.
So, oh, wow. Have you actually done that before, or is this the first time?
I have been to Graceland before, but I am going again with friends who've seen the movie and now are obsessed. And so we're going to go and do that. I haven't been to Tupelo, where Elvis was born, so that's what we're going to do this time. And we're going to go and sit in the cinema that he used to sit in and watch all of his movies late at night, you know, go to Lauderdale.
I have been to Graceland myself, and it was fantastic. And
yes, but it's now got all extra stuff. It's got the movie exhibit as well.
Oh, right. Nice. Well, I guess it would have to, really, wouldn't it? The worst thing was we didn't actually have that much time, and it was like I had to do like a mission around the gift shop to buy loads of gifts for people.
Yeah.
Because there was so much to choose from, and it was actually for once not terrible kind of tat. I mean, it was tat, but, you know, and it kind of like, I got an Elvis cookbook, for example. That was good.
Why would you want that, though? also, Elvis, can we just say Elvis never lifted a finger in the kitchen?
Well, he probably didn't, to be fair.
He didn't cook a damn thing. But what is it, just peanut butter and jelly deep fried sandwiches?
That type of thing, yes. I don't think it was actually, I don't think it's been utilised, this cookbook, but it was still quite a nice little memento.
Because a man used to eat a pound of bacon for breakfast every day.
I'm aiming for that myself.
Okay. Have you had a pound of bacon this morning?
No, I haven't. I wish I had.
You better get to it. Go and have a snack now. Okay. On that note, we will say goodbye and we'll be back next week. And so until then, say goodbye.
Bye.
Bye. Wah, bah, bloom, bah, blah, bah, bah, toot-a-boo. She rock to the west, but she's the gal that I love best. To the booty, on Rudy. Oh, wop, bop, loom, bop, lop, bop.